Hello. Welcome to another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking, the podcast series by the Young Lockwood Sauer team at UBS in Houston. I'm your host, Liz DeMontron. I'm one of the financial advisors on the team. For compliance purposes, our team's phone number is 713-940-2872. As always, I'm very happy to be here today. I am joined by my teammate, fellow financial advisor, and podcast regular, Barry Young. Welcome to the pod, BY. Hello.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Yeah. No, great to have you back in the studio. And I'm super excited to welcome our guests today. But Barry, I'm actually going to turn the floor over to you in terms of our introductions.
Yeah, thanks. We're switching the switching roles here a little bit.
Exactly.
I did script out a little introduction because, you know, I was thinking about, well, first of all, our guest today is Oliver White. And I was thinking about, you know, what to say about Oliver. And we've been friends for a long time. And I didn't think I would get it right unless I sort of wrote it down a little bit. But if you asked Oliver what he does for a living, he would simply say he's a fisherman. And as an introduction, I would simply say that he's my friend. And in the course of being a fisherman and our decade-long friendship, I've known him to play a lot of roles. So, you know, as an introduction, Oliver White is a fishing guide, an author, a Wall Street analyst, a hotelier, a travel consultant, philanthropist, conservationist, brand ambassador, businessman, casting instructor, fashion icon, private equity investor, a rum entrepreneur, a retailer, and of course, a dad. And in the ranks of fly fishing, did I miss anything?
It all blurs together anymore.
In the ranks of fly fishing, especially, Oliver White is an iconic figure and always an ambassador of the sport of fly fishing. And he was recently featured in the Yeti-produced short film, 1,000 Casts. He's the founder of Abaco Lodge in the Bahamas, former owner of Bears Lodge in Andros, Bahamas, and the current owner of South Fork Lodge in Swan Valley, Idaho. But more than anything, Oliver is a curious life participant and an adventurer, not to mention one of the luckiest guys that I know. And it is our good luck to have him here in our studio today, Liz.
Wow. Well, what an introduction. I'm so glad that we did have you give the intro. Oliver, it's such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Welcome here today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Yes.
So should we start with a little March Madness?
I'm a Carolina grad.
Got Carolina versus Princeton slash UVA. We got ready-made rivalry going.
I was about to say, Princeton did not make the tournament, but yeah, the Cavaliers are in it. So
yeah, and Tar Heels are number one seed.
Ooh.
And their first couple games are in Charlotte.
I saw that. And my first question is, when you think about your time at Carolina and your philosophy degree, you know, how do you think your liberal arts education has colored your career at this stage, looking back? How has it borne fruit?
There's several things there. One, I didn't have a life plan per se as an undergrad. I kind of thought I would go to graduate school, law school particularly, and philosophy was where I just naturally gravitated towards. And I got a lot of flack at the time for, you know, one of these useless little art degrees. But for me, it made me a very curious thinker and a problem solver. And it's some of the skills I use the most in being an entrepreneur and doing all the things I do were those problem solving skills that a lot of what philosophy ultimately is. And I do think it's a great perspective to kind of view the world with an inquisitive mind. And I would encourage anybody to study it like in a deep way. I think it's really, really valuable.
Yeah. Oliver's been on a lot of podcasts and of course, most recently the Yeti movie. So I think a lot of people are who know who he is are familiar, you know, with your background. So I didn't want to go back into the annals of the Oliver White origin story, but I wanted to ask you, and there's some really good podcasts out. I thought, you know, there was one recently you were talking about risk and, you know, as it pertained to business risk. And I wanted to get into that, you know, in a second. I thought that was a really interesting sort of side comment that you're,
might have to remind me.
But I was curious how many countries you've already visited this year. And I want to talk a little bit about travel. This year, six. Six, not even the quarter's over.
Yeah,
it's not six even countries.
April. Wow.
Remarkable. And what do you think the state of world travel is here now that we're kind of through the COVID and post-COVID era? And, you know, how are logistics and, you know, is revenge travel still a thing? You know, I mean, you're moving around more than most people. What are some of your observations there?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's easier to move around the world now than it's ever been. And also kind of post-COVID, it is more annoying than it's probably ever been as well. Like there's a lot of tension and anger in the crowd. Planes are full, planes are late, you know, and, you know, the derailment is very real. But at the same time, and you can get anywhere in the world relatively easily these days, and takes a little bit of patience.
And on that note, I mean, operating in certain countries, it involves an elevated degree of risk, danger, maybe even. And, you know, you've had some close calls over the years in different countries. And, you know, how do you process that now than when you were first started moving around? And this is the part where you can tell a war story. And the one that I was reminded of when I was thinking about this is the Venezuela uprising, which took place a while ago, but yeah. It's a good one.
Did I tell that story in a podcast? I don't even remember.
I think you told that over a glass of rum.
Oh, yeah.
No, not on a podcast, no.
You know, risk is also opportunity, right? So when you can navigate something that is perceived as risk, that is ultimately a way to help create value. And one of the things that I feel like I've excelled at is to be able to go somewhere with a degree of perceived risk and kind of create something that people wanted to be a part of. And I shouldered the risk and I put all of the fear and all those things kind of behind a curtain and shared all the good of what those places were with people. The Bahamas was a great example. I mean, I lived there for a bunch of years and it's an amazing country. It's a particularly amazing country to visit in a week when you can look at all the wonderful things that are there and how rich the resource is and how jovial the culture is. And the challenge of running a business there gets hidden from those customers that are only coming for a few days at a time. So they get to come, they see all the good, and your job as the entrepreneur, as the, you know, unlocking the value is to put all the negativity and all the risk and all the fear kind of behind the curtain so they don't have to touch that. And when you do that, you create wonderful memories for people. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Relative to travelers, I mean, what is your advice for, you know, when things go wrong?
I think the biggest thing is you have to anticipate that they will go wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like if you are naive enough to think that nothing will ever happen, then you're almost certainly a mark. And in a lot of ways, they create great stories. And I've had a bunch of random things happen. And I mean, we were off exploring in Venezuela, chasing Payara, which is this big vampire fish in the jungles of Venezuela, when Chavez died. And like all of a sudden we're in the middle of nowhere and the military shows up and there's protest, and it was kind of novel in one sense. But I use a great company called Global Rescue that does like not only medical evacuations, but security evacuations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you call up on the satellite phone and say, this is where I am. This is what's going on.
Enhanced travel insurance.
Yeah. And they're professionals, a lot of ex-military. And in that case, we were in the internal jungles of Venezuela, and to get out, they didn't extract us or anything, but they did help us reroute our travel to a safer way to avoid some protests and things like that on our way out.
Are there some places now that you are itching to go that you don't consider safe?
Oh yeah, tons. Actually, almost everything I want to do now that I haven't done is not considered safe. I've been trying to go to Yemen for years. I've been playing a lot in Oman in the Middle East. I really love the visuals and the fishing and the culture is very fascinating. And like it just, you feel like you're really out there, and that borders Yemen, but not even mainland Yemen where it is and has been dangerous for a long time. But Yemen owns an island called Socotra, which is off the coast of Somalia. And it's like the only place in the world the dragon's blood trees grow, and they're permit there. And there's this cool parrotfish called an emerald parrotfish, and there's big bonefish, and there's giant trevallies. And I've been trying to go for a few years, and it's just kind of right on the edge of that risk tolerance, which I will admit has slid more conservatively as I've had kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about that for a second. Do you think you're reassessing your degree of risk to take, and now that you're family man.
So I have two boys, and it definitely kind of re-triggers the balance of normal. And at the same time, the adventure and the travel and like the pushing the limits there is a big part of who I am. So I'm not willing to give that up either, but obviously try not to make, you know, stupid decisions, and also pushing my kids to go the right way. Like I just took my oldest boy down to Guyana where I do some nonprofit work and took him down to the middle of the jungle, 150 miles from the nearest road, dug out canoes, fishing with the indigenous people. And, he's six.
Yeah. Guyana is interesting because it highlights what you're talking about is asymmetry of the reward when you go and do this kind of exploratory fishing. And, maybe you could outline what the target species was, because it's quite unique. And tell us how you've gotten involved with that community.
So Guyana is one of my favorite projects I've ever done. And we're probably more than a dozen years into it now. But originally went down kind of exploring. I heard that there was this big fish that at the time I didn't even know what it was. No one I really knew what it was. And it's called an arapaima. It's the largest scaled freshwater fish in the world. And they've been harvested to extinction because they're really good to eat. But they were making a comeback in little small pockets of the jungle. And we went down there to try to figure out how to catch them on the fly, really just for the adventure. And the adventure was amazing, but we also kind of became enamored with the people and the village. And so we founded a nonprofit called IndieFly, where the sole goal is to create sustainable livelihoods for indigenous people. And the way we do that is with the skills that I have is teaching them how to run their own fishing lodges where they own it and they benefit economically. And when they do that, they become conservationists. Mm-hmm. And so now in the middle of the jungle, you have this little village called Rewa Village with 250 people. And the majority of the working adults are employed by this fishing lodge. And there's been multi-generational improvement in quality of life. I mean, they have satellite internet, they have running water. There's a school, we built a church, we built, a cafeteria for the school. Nurses come in and provide healthcare, and it's all driven by bringing anglers there to a place that would have been so adventurous to try to execute that now people just go and you can just book the trip and show up and get taken care of and have this amazing experience, and all the money stays in the community.
Right. But beyond just the community, it's had like an incredible, almost a compounded impact. I mean, you really have had almost an angel investor impact and role in that community, but it's gone beyond the borders of the village. I mean, you've saved an incredible amount of rainforest in the process.
Yeah. So, I mean, beyond that, yeah.
Was that intended, or was that ancillary benefit?
A lot of it just kind of, we knew that they would protect what they had, but they had more than we expected. I mean, you're talking a village that has almost 400 square miles of rainforest. And what has happened is they have now, and the paperwork is still being processed, but they have a petition before the government to double their tribal lands, all in an effort to protect this fish that creates their livelihood. So you're talking by helping a very small community of a couple hundred people create a business that can employ the majority of them and put money in their community, you're going to end up with 700 square miles of rainforest that are protected in perpetuity so that foreigners can come there and catch fish and let them go. Pretty amazing.
It's a massive return.
Yeah.
On that little investment. And,
yeah.
I think it underscores, how you can make a difference, in following your passions.
Yeah, most definitely. That one, it really, it touches greatly, which is why I wanted to take my son, Huckleberry, down there, just because it has been so impactful for me. And so, taking him at six and being welcomed and part of the community, and he gets to see it. And I also took my wife, and she had gone with me on one of the very early trips and had not been in a while. And so her observations were very, very appreciative, just recognizing, she's like, everybody's had dental work. Everybody's wearing shoes. Everybody has, clean clothes and multiple sets of clothes. And it was just a radical improvement of quality of life, like on every measure.
And you've taken that template. I mean, you've almost inspired yourself to take that template and go and stamp it into other communities around the world.
Yeah, we've done a few other projects now as well. We have one in Lesotho in French Polynesia. Lesotho is in Africa. Then we do one in French Polynesia as well, and on an island called Anna. And we are currently deep into a project domestically on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. And that's going to be the next big one. The kind of disenfranchisement of First Nation people here in America is amazing. And the Wind River Reservation is fascinating. It's bigger than Yellowstone National Park. I see this giant resource and these incredible fishing and a community with 85% unemployment that you can have a real impact with something like this.
Yeah. You know, most people, they focus on impact investing and philanthropic activity kind of almost post-career, but you're in the middle of embroiled in a huge project right now. And, you know, back to, you know, the nature of risk is, you know, sometimes these things are out of your control. And, you know, your Abaco Lodge was rolled by a hurricane. You know, you had an act of God and, you know, you made kind of an amazing pivot, as I see it, from that endeavor into South Fork. And, in a way, it's like starting over again, and a new, you know, you move your family across the country. So, maybe talk a little bit about that change, and you know, and Liz, to be sure, like those two lodges in the Bahamas were the best lodges in the Bahamas. You know, the pinnacle of the Bahamian fishing experience, and you know, you've, by my way of thinking, you've replicated a lot of the soul of that endeavor at South Fork, but it's a different beast entirely.
Yeah, I think all those things are true. So I had two lodges in the Bahamas and yet put a lot of energy into it. And I think soul is the right word, right? There are a lot of higher end properties, but they're kind of soulless corporate feelings. And I think to kind of create a soul in a place that could become an institution is really what I look for. And the Bahamas was wonderful, but it was a very difficult place to operate. And there was a giant hurricane, totally wiped Abaco Lodge off the map. And yeah, and then an opportunity really just in being an entrepreneur. I mean, I look at every fishing lodge that trades hands, and there's one for sale on the South Fork in Eastern Idaho called South Fork Lodge. And it had been there for a long time. And it also happened to be a place I knew, right? I mean, I started my guiding career in Jackson Hole, so it wasn't actually that foreign to me. I mean, you know, Jackson's an hour from this place, and I used to go over to the South Fork and fish quite a bit and knew people that had worked there. And same thing. In that case, it was owned by this big kind of conglomerate, and it was a soulless entity, and they didn't understand the space. And but at the same time, they had like an irreplaceable asset on the water and just had a belief that I could help turn it around.
So you started, you know, two lodges at different times in your life, and you know, Abaco really from scratch. South Fork, you know, took under your wing as a rehabilitation project. And you juxtapose those two experiences, I mean, relative to looking back.
Yeah, there's greenfielding something is nice in the sense that you get to create your own standards and culture from the beginning. And turning something around is challenging because you're, especially something that was broken, is because there typically was a culture there that was failing anyway. And then the other thing is these also have happened at different points of my life and levels of maturity. So with South Fork, with a turnaround, when we first bought it, like I left the entire staff there and just said, hey, I'm just in addition to it. I want to see what you guys do and all of that. And very quickly, it was like, this just isn't going to work. And I mean, it made me really kind of understand and embrace why turnaround CEOs just bring in their own team, right? Like, it's just like to try to get people to pivot away from something that they are close to, whether or not they held it dearly or not, it was just part of their identity. They just resist that degree of change. And then the culture is really important, especially in something where you are trying to really build a soul. And like, ultimately that's where I start, is in kind of the culture of hospitality. And that starts with the way you kind of interact and treat your employees. And when you empower them, you kind of create this opportunity for them to rise to the occasion. And by and large, they usually do.
South Fork, it's a lot more than a lodge though. I mean, it's a lodge, it's a hotel, it's a restaurant, it's a bar.
It's an experience.
It's a fly shop.
It's also just at a scale that's really unusual for fly fishing, right? When you look at the ones I had in the Bahamas, we were taking 12 people a week. There's 40 bedrooms in South Fork, right? I mean, we have a massive degree of scale. I mean, this year I'll cross 100 employees for the first time. I mean, it's a very big enterprise. Absolutely. And it is. It's all of these things and none of them all at the same time. It's a hotel. It's a restaurant. It's a bar. It's a retail store. It's an outfitting business. And none of those accurately describe it, but it is all of those things all wrapped up into one.
An advocate, when you had it, basically step of one, you've described to me, you know, a sense of maybe fear, I guess, and trying something totally new. And I'm curious, like with the scale of South Fork, and again, the idea of starting something totally new, did you have similar feelings as when you started Abaco, or that you'd done it before, you know, you had more confidence, even though the scale was infinitely bigger?
Yeah, I think both of those things are true, right? I don't think it has to be a decision there. Both the level of confidence increased. Like I knew that it could be made successful. What I didn't know was the timeline. And ultimately it happened exponentially faster than I anticipated. And that level of growth is really challenging. It's really hard to both create a team and explode a team all at the same time. And we're in the middle of that now. I mean, I spent a lot of time interviewing candidates as we look to grow. But I think kind of relating it back to investing, you know, I did spend a little bit of time in my life in the financial space. And one of the key takeaways was that is looking for asymmetrical returns, right? And so when you can cap your downside and you have unlimited upside, those are always good trades. And South Fork always had that, right? Because ultimately I was buying an irreplaceable asset on the body of water that you could never, ever replicate. It's going to be the only one. And even if I fell on my face, I felt that the purchase price for the underlying asset was less than intrinsic value. And then if you can create an operating business on top of that that does well, that was the upside. And so in a lot of ways, it was an incredible deal because of that, right? Like your downside was really capped. You might have to be able to weather a little bit of storm for the real estate world to turn around, but that was doable in the structure. And then the upside was really unlimited way better than I anticipated. Or model, whatever you want it to be.
Right. And now as far as the operating model goes, you're adding a pretty big retail operation now.
Yeah. We just built a giant fly shop and experiential retail, right? Yeah.
Do the paparazzi still show up at South Fork?
Occasionally. Yeah. We get a little bit of that.
What are your, on that subject, I have to ask, what are your observations around celebrity culture and how has that challenged you there? It's rather unique. Some of your guests, you know, are people that anyone would recognize. You know, I think on one of the podcasts that I listened to recently, you mentioned that the time that people come fishing is the most valuable time that they spend. I really like that idea a lot. Yeah, maybe you can expound on those two things.
You're rolling a couple into one, but yeah. I think one of the things that really helped my career path explode and blossom into being more than just a fishing guide was, man, when I was young and I was guiding, I was doing well at it. And I had collected some very affluent and famous clients. And early on for me, there was a recognition that the service that I was providing, which I didn't realize at the time, but was really valuable. And the way that hit me was going to visit people in their homes and their offices. And, you know, I had clients that are kind of moving the world, you know, the masters of the universe, and the pictures on their walls were the time that I spent with people like me. And, you know, when you have made it and I watch people just like the anticipation and joy they get from the time they spend outside. In my case, it's fishing, but it could be lots of different pursuits. You know, that is their most valuable time. And so one of the things that I work with my team is that recognition of it never really matters what we charge for the experience we're working to create for people. The most valuable thing anyone ever gives us is their time. And because it's some of their most precious time, it's their free time, and they're choosing to spend it and they're looking forward to it. And it's part of their identity of who they are. And I've watched it touch a lot of people that really really benefit from it. And I think one of the reasons that fly fishing is unique in that, and that you get so many alpha successful people, whether they're famous or finance or business or whatever it is I love that fishing and fly fishing specifically, it takes just enough thought that you can't think about anything else, right? But not so much that you're taxed. So you are very much in this state of zen, right? Like, it's just really hard for people to disconnect. But when you are really fishing and paying attention, man, you are in the moment, like you were living in that like tight little moment of the fish and making the cast and getting connected to this creature with a piece of string. And it's a real moment of zen that I think really busy, successful people struggle to find.
I'm busy, but I don't think I'm successful, but I can identify with that.
Yeah,
for sure. And a lot more people are coming to South Fork that are not anglers, or they're maybe the plus one, which is another dynamic, and they may or may not be celebrity. You know, how have you accommodated their experience?
You know, early on, even when I was in the Bahamas, one of the things I realized is that often the people booking the trips, it's a very male-dominated sport. Women happens to be the fastest growing part, but still, for the most part, most of your clientele are males. But most of the people booking trips were female assistants, right? And so when you communicated to them about the things that would get their attention and you were executing the fishing, right? Like, it all starts with being in the right place for the resource, and the fishing is the core. But then for me, a way to differentiate ourselves in business was to really pay attention to the hospitality and the whole experience. Whereas a lot of fishing lodges are run by fishing guides. So you eat peanut butter jelly and like you sleep on hard beds, and you get to a point of life when people can afford it and are willing to spend the money to create an experience that from the moment they walk in to going on the water and coming back home can be curated to create something really magical. And that's what we do. And with that means that you do attract kind of, you know, the next couple deviations from the hardcore angler. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that's a good thing.
Yes, that's why I'll be spending a few days this summer there with my family, because Oliver's got it nailed down. I wanted to take it back as we kind of get to conclusion, and we'll take it back to the Bahamas for a second, because, you know, that's where we met. It's a special place. Best from there. Your boys are Bahamian citizens, correct?
Correct, yeah.
We were just there together, and it's also your next stop tomorrow. Maybe you could ruminate on the Bahamas a minute, because it was your first choice to go set up a lodge, and at least that was your first one, and you really had to commit to stay there in a lot of ways. And I know you have mixed feelings about leaving. You know, the Bahamas is so close to the U.S. yet like people identify it with Atlantis and casinos. But why, I wanted to ask you why you thought it was special.
The Bahamas, as an angler, as someone who loves the outdoors, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's one of the most pristine, intact ecosystems. It's one of the healthiest fisheries. It is really remarkable. I've said before, and I still think it's true, that I think it's the best bone fishing in the world for the ease of access. And that is not Nassau, which is where kind of Atlantis and Bahamar and what most people experience the Bahamas with this cruise industry exists. You know, all the out islands of the Bahamas, it's pretty magical. And, you know, from Abaco to Andros to, you know, Crooked and Acklands, I mean, these are amazing places, you know, with relatively small communities and an infinite resource that they've really benefited. Because it's so difficult to do business there, it's so difficult to develop there, that you can go up and down this beautiful, pristine shoreline of beautiful white sand beaches, and there's nothing there. And the fisheries are really healthy, and it's really spectacular. And it's very difficult to execute a high-end experience. And part of the challenge is everyone speaks English. They take the American dollar. It's very close. You expect things to work like they do in the United States, and that's not the case. And so you have to be willing to embrace that and figure that out. And my wife is a Bahamian. I met her in the Bahamas when I built my first lodge. And a story I often share is we were on one of our very first dates, and I'm driving, and she's like, "Is that a P.O. box key?" I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "How'd you get a P.O. box?" I'm like, "Well, I went to the post office and I said, hey, I just moved here and I'm opening a business. I need to get a P.O. box." And the lady laughed at me and told me there was a 10-year wait. And I thought she was just messing with me. So I was like, really? That seems crazy. Cause then, you know, I've got a business, I'm going to have bills, and there's got to be something I can do. And she immediately went on and tell me about this thing at her church. And I just said, that sounds awesome. I'd love to support that. I gave her $100 and I got a PO box key. And my wife, who's Bahamian, had been on the waiting list for 7 years because there is a 10-year wait to get a PO box. You know, but that is part of it, is learning how to navigate this culture and solve problems and think on your feet and recognize that, you know, you kind of have to keep pushing for the answer.
Will y'all do a little fishing when you go visit?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, all of Best Brothers are, you know, commercial fishermen. So we'll be on the boat and get the boys diving for lobster a little bit and definitely do a little bone fishing as well.
I know Charlie's too young, but do you see both of them picking up the fly rod in the future?
You know, I push myself very hard to not push things on them, but they're getting exposure and I hope they gravitate towards it. I've got a pretty privileged life as far as those experiences and hope to share it and hope that they find the joy in it that I do.
Yeah, that's maybe some good advice for you, Liz, in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess as we conclude, I kind of want to start with the beginning. For those of us, you know, who maybe are newer to your story, what did draw you to fishing and when was that? And this joy that you're talking about, you know, what are your thoughts? Like, how are you passing that along to the people who are visiting your?
Yeah, for me, like, even as a young kid, I found fishing. And it wasn't fly fishing, but like as a little kid, my dad was not an angler. But I mean, I would like run around and catch little fish in creeks and bass, whether it was a cane pole or a spinning rod and all of that. And really, as a teenager, just started to dabble in fly fishing a little bit, but I was doing lots of outdoor things there. And when I was in college, I had a really bad accident and I broke my back and my pelvis and my hip and, you know, my sacrum. And I, you know, missed a whole year of school. And in that recovery process, you know, I had this back brace and I was in a walker and I was 19 and back at home and just miserable. And I would go out in the yard with my walker and cast my fly rod just as a bit of mental therapy as much of anything. And that kind of repetitive kind of rhythmic casting was a big part of me getting in a better place as I physically healed. And so as I recovered from that, I really gravitated towards fishing and it kind of became my one true pursuit. And it just blossomed from there.
How incredible to be able to pass that along, you know, to your guests who can experience that same, kind of physical and mental respite.
I think a lot of that's underappreciated. You know, a lot of fishing guides are notorious for barking and yelling and stuff. So we work really hard on keeping people in the zone.
And Oliver, you know, you have attracted a following. I mean, we've walked through many of the world's airports and people will stop Oliver and, you know, touch his beard or say hello. But you represent a number of different really interesting brands as Howler, Yeti, Loomis, Nautilus. Anybody else?
Costa. TurtleBox. A bunch of fun stuff.
Yeah. So is there any new gear out there that we need to be aware of for Father's Day, Liz, for your Father's Day list?
Well, I tell you, that last little one I mentioned, it's a Texas company, but TurtleBox is this little waterproof outdoor speaker. And man, it's one of these things I didn't know how much I needed it till I started using it. It's just a killer product and they do a great job and everybody can use it. You can take it everywhere. It's awesome.
And you're affiliated with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great guys.
Yeah. Great. So. And we'll be able to get it remotely at the fly shop sometime soon.
It's there.
Okay, we're ready to go.
Ready to go.
And maybe to finish this off, you can tell us what a Swan Valley Monster is.
Yeah, we are on the hunt for the Swan Valley Monster right now. And there's an old book of folklore and mythology. And in that is this creature called the Swan Valley Monster. South Fork Lodge is in Swan Valley, which is a population of 270 people. Right. And in this giant book, there's this creature with like an elephant trunk and wings and that lived in the river. And it was seen once, I think like in the 1860s. So we stay on the lookout for it. And just one of these random little weird things that we found doing the diligence for the lodge that we just kind of loved and embraced. And so we're going to play with that a little bit here.
And to finish up, I know your next trip is Bahamas, but what's your next dedicated fishing trip?
I do a trip every year in the spring for big tarpon up in the Panhandle, Florida. And so I go every May and fish with kind of a guy that's at the top of his game named David Mangum.
Right.
Try to do big tarpon on fly. So I do that, and I'll go with that in May. Then my next, then is the middle of the season for us in South Fork, and then going back to Cape York in Northern Australia in the fall, chasing purpose.
Well, I'm wishing you good luck on that adventure and all the subsequent ones, even though I know you don't need it, but I'm going to wish it for you anyway.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much again for joining, Oliver. Thank you, Barry. This has been another great episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking. This is your host, Liz DeMontron, signing off. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.